On that note, huge thank you and shout out to volunteer producer Griffin Rhyme for researching and co-hosting today. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm taking a little break, but we'll be back with new episodes in a month or two. Until then, you can find all episodes of Coast Range Radio free and ad-free on all podcast apps. If you're not already, please consider following and subscribing so you never miss an episode. Not to brag, but we also post clips on Instagram whenever we remember to. Pretty cool like that. And finally, the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Send us a note sometime and let us know what you think of the show. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Rachel Haynes, broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. My co-host, Stephen Siegel, isn't able to join me today, but both of us are public school teachers and host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. Joining us today is Angela Bonilla. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. So you're nearing the end of your second term as president of the Portland Association of Teachers. But before
That's
we
right.
talk about that, can you share what your teaching experience was prior to your leadership position?
Yeah. So thanks for having me. I am 115 days from the end of my term, but who's counting? Before I became president of the Portland Association of Teachers, if we go way back, I mean, I've been doing tutoring, counseling, things like that since high school, but I was an early childhood educator, mainly with infants and toddlers, but up to pre-K for about 5 years. And that included being a caseworker of Volunteers of America, Oregon, their family relief nursery for families at risk of abuse. And I was providing like home parenting classes as well as respite care for infants. But I did that for a few years and then for about 5 years. And then I worked as an education assistant at PPS for 2 years. And then I was part of a program that got bilingual and multicultural folks into teaching and teaching programs through PPS. So I began teaching while getting my master's and my certification in Spanish dual language immersion, mostly fourth and sixth grade. And then the last 2 years before I became president, I was an instructional coach at Scott Elementary.
Awesome. Well, very diverse early career. I like that. So getting into your time in office, reflecting on your time, what are some of the most important successes or wins PAT has had during that time, both in terms of tangible gains and any kind of cultural or organizational shifts within the union?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the most public and obvious one is our 2023 contract and eventual strike for 15 days, which is, I think, still one of the longest education strikes. I mean, I know it's the longest one we've had here in recent history. And I think from that contract, for the first time, planning time for elementary educators and middle school educators was anywhere comparable to that for high school educators. When I started at PPS, we had, I think, 260 minutes of planning as elementary educators, while our high school compadres, our high school comrades, had an average of 450 minutes a week. So, and that's part of their schedule of teaching 6 of 8. Across a 2-day AB schedule. So we had to sacrifice staff meetings, which was such a loss, in order to get to that planning time for K-8. And, you know, I think there are some educators who are still a little salty about feeling like maybe they didn't win enough in that contract, but that was huge for folks who haven't been centered in a lot of contracts before. But we also got those grading days for all educators, which was something that I know high school educators really needed with the amount of, with their large class sizes and the amount of work outside of school for grading in order to plan for the next few days. And it made us comparable to other districts who have had planning and grading days for years, which is really, really important. I think also another kind of maybe not as tangible or mid-tangible slash untangible is the connection we built with families and the popular education that we were able to do around the quality education model, the kicker, how state funding has been happening. I mean, before 2022, it was something you had to be like an insider to really talk about or understand. And we didn't see QEM in the news that often, but I think a lot of the work that we did doing that popular education and working with families was influential in that. I went and applied for a grant that allowed us to hire a community organizer, and this grant was through NEA. So, you know, Joanne Shepherd, who was our community organizer, was able to work with parents, PTAs, parents who were frustrated with how PTAs were moving, and then eventually broke off and built up Communities and Parents for Public Schools, CPPS. So, you know, they are a force in their own right, and I will not claim credit for the work that they've done. But it was definitely one of the, like, beautiful byproducts of opening up our union hall and our doors to community and saying, we're going to not just have a transactional relationship where we show up when we want something. We're going to show up whether we get something or not, because you're part of our community and we want to support you. And then I think lastly is kind of like the structural changes due to members engaging and wanting to hold me and each other accountable after the strike. You know, we did a lot of surveys. We had focus group conversations with folks who were involved in the strike, leading the work, our CAT team, our contract action team, our bargaining team, our elected officials, like our executive board, as well as our members and our reps. And then we just took time as staff and officers to go through all that data and pull out learnings with help from a coach. So I think a lot of the changes that came after that, changing our bylaws, changing to have a expanded bargaining team, passing a vision for PAT, which we hadn't had before. I think those things really helped us make tangible the things that we were saying were part of our ideals and practices. So I think those were pretty great, and us having really dope staff that we've been able to hire. And I think also just the impact we had on the rest of the labor movement in Portland and Oregon. I mean, I've had nurses come up to me and say, you know, I didn't think we could strike and leave our patients. But the fact that you guys went on strike showed us that it's worth it, because they deserve more and they can't be the only ones out here suffering. Like, we have to make that suffering visible for everyone else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then seeing places like Greater Albany and small locals on the coast threatening a strike credibly, that's not something that would have happened before we went on strike in 2023. So I think it was a strike and then a lot of the ripple effects from that.
Yeah. And I get, you just made me think that, you know, another ripple effect that we don't even get to fully realize until later is that we are showing children, kids, what it looks like when people come together in solidarity and fight for something that improves the lives of not just ourselves, but everybody that we serve and other unions and workers in the community. And that's, you know, kind of a gift or a lesson that, you know, they are growing up seeing that as a possibility, that that is an action that they can take in their own lives as adults.
Absolutely. I anecdotally, we did a lot of bargaining at the firefighters union hall during the strike. And one of the leaders there shared a video of his kiddo who is, you know, who sleeps in a crib still, is like, you know, about 2 or 3 years old. A video from her chanting while in bed to her stuffies of like, I don't want you to fight. That is why we have to fight. Education is the right. So, you know, kids, because we made sure that kids came to our picket lines and our rallies, and we made this an action that was for all of us because we were fighting for all of us. So I think you're spot on with that.
So you've talked a little bit about some of the work you did post strike to kind of reflect on your processes and how things went. But what have been some of the struggles you've encountered during your whole tenure as president? And were there any hard learned lessons from that time?
Yeah, there were lots of challenges. You know, in Portland, which is a very white city, and the data shows like we are predominantly a white workforce compared to our students. Folks were not ready to deal with the fact that I was like the first Afro-Latina president of PA, of the largest education local in the state of Oregon under OEA. So, you know, there were a lot of things that I didn't quite talk about during the time, but now that I'm 15 days away, everybody can hear about all of it. But, you know, we found a bullet was very intentionally placed on the PAT porch during our strike buildup. The type of hate mail I got wishing to have me burned in effigy, or you know, people printing out photos of me wearing a PAT BLM shirt and talking about how, like, of course, I'm this like fat, queer, black, radical trying to like destroy our schools. It was to the point where things were being mailed and folks were checking the mail before I did. I had to keep everything in an evidence baggie, and we were turning things over to the feds because some of it was coming from USPS, like through the federal mail. The types of things people think they can email me and say to me as if I am not a real human being, especially once we started advocating against the genocide in Gaza before it became a common sense thing for folks. Mm-hmm. As one of the locals that signed on to the U.S. Labor Against Racism and War letter saying we wanted a ceasefire, And then some of the actions that some of our leaders took that we had to reevaluate and change practices and set up new rules because, you know, we were a sleepy union who didn't do a lot of these things. So once you do it, a lot of times you're learning through trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
I still get emails calling me, signing me up for email lists with the name Hamas on it. Like, it is there are folks who say very cruel things to me based on my race and gender and all these things. And there's also that like underlying level of disrespect, right? There's a book called Unrig the Game by Vanessa Priya Daniels, where she talks about how women of color leaders are often benched before the big game, you know, because there are some like five consistent barriers, and she called them, you know, we are brought in to lead an organization that's at the brink of failure, often in nonprofits. We have an assumption of incompetence, so folks just assume that I don't know what I'm doing. An expectation to mother and mammy folks. So when people's feelings are hurt, I am expected to drop everything and deal with that. The zero margin for error. I mean, there are plenty of people who came before me who made mistakes that were even more egregious in a lot of different ways, including ways that reduced people's compensation on our salary scale, but no one blames them. As soon as a white dude puts an article in the Oregonian about his plight, now I'm villainized. There's no question about whether I was wrong or not. And then the last one, which is when we're attacked, we are abandoned, right? I mean, I think there was a very clear, united message during the strike. And as soon as folks started feeling the reality of our district being dysfunctional, and some internal dynamics that made it really difficult for us to get our work done because of folks dropping the ball and not doing their work appropriately and no accountability around it, it was all me because I am the president. I am the face of the organization. And so it was very hard sustaining that amount of pressure for 4 years and scrutiny with very few people, not very few people in support. It's just the angry voices are always louder than the supportive voices because the supportive voices are trying to survive in this awful system while those who aren't are trying to bring everyone to the same level of despair that they're feeling. So it's been a lot of work to keep myself sane during this time. And I joke that any extra pay I get as president, according to my bylaws, just goes to therapy. It's just hazard pay for being in this position. But I think, you know, some of the hard learned lessons structurally and organizationally are just kind of like, you know, if you are going to be a leader, you have to work to disperse that power. It can't just be you. Like, one of my biggest fears is that we get some sense of, like, for lack of a better term, founder's syndrome, and things are put on me as if it was just Angela, when it never was just me. It was always a lot of people doing a lot of work behind the scenes, but my face is on the newspaper, or my quote is in the news. Mm-hmm. Right. So really making sure that we were turning that hierarchy into a circle and trying to engage leaders in, like, there are some things that I can't change, right? Our bylaws say that I am the sole spokesperson, but can we train a bureau of speakers so that when interviews are being called, it's educators actually doing the work, talking about what they're experiencing, things like that. And dispersing power so that, you know, I can't be personally blamed for something that is being decided upon by 30 bargaining team members because it's democratically elected and it's representative. Things that weren't put in place or necessarily valued before. So I think, you know, I learned a lot about how to make the learning visible. because there's so much that goes behind the scenes. Like, folks aren't that interested in the non-sexy, like, we now have new committee structures. We now have different ways of tracking engagement. We now have racial equity trainings that are integrated into our bargaining trainings. Like, those are things that aren't as sexy, but are really important. And, you know, even the fact that our reps now file grievances, which was unacceptable previous to my terms. But the workload was too big and no one could complete it. I was like, why don't our reps get trained on filing grievances and representing other members? And then we have hundreds of people who can follow up. Those are the kinds of things that, again, as folks learn more, they're like, wait, this system sucks. And I'm like, yeah, a little bit, but that's why we bargain and fix it. And also, the more people that are aware of it, the more pressure we can put on. So, you know, I think those are kind of some of the bigger hard learned lessons. And, you know, I realize, as painful and as hard as it's been being president for these 4 years, I'm really proud of the work, and I see it when I see kids of color who recognize me. So I've been added to a few Black History Month presentations and articles that folks have written, that kids have written about powerful women of color and Black women leaders, and in multiple languages. And it kind of reminds me again why I was willing to do this work, or why I put my name in the hat, why I fought to be in this position. Because there will be kids in Portland, Oregon who get to see someone like me lead.
Yeah. And you were on a bus.
And I was on a bus. I was on a mural that is on a bus that still runs off of Broadway. I see that one often with my face on it.
So. I was very excited to see that the first time.
Yeah.
So in our last about 10-ish minutes, a little less, I would like you to touch on some of your work you've done with other labor organizations around the country, as well as international social movements. Can you talk about your views on working class solidarity and how you see that connecting to education, and also share some of the work that's come out of these collaborations?
Yeah, I'll keep these a little shorter, snappier. I think some of the work that we've done in terms of international social movements, I mean, first, my vision and my thought around that is that, you know, the billionaires are colluding across the nation and the world. Those who are putting us in this mess have allegiance to each other. Like, we need to have that working class solidarity across the whole world. So one thing that I'm really proud of, the work that we've been doing, and that my vice president, Alicia Chavez, and president-elect of PAT is really spearheading, is work with the Global Labor Justice organization around Nike. We're pushing that Nike campaign of making sure that they pay their fair share of taxes here in Oregon, as well as pay their workers in their factories in Southeast Asia the wages that they're owed. And, you know, pushing back, we've testified in front of the Oregon Investment Council, telling them to divest from Nike until they have proper relationships with their workers. We are, and we're going to continue this work into next year. And we have a training coming up actually Saturday, March 14th on how to train folks in Portland on how they can connect with this campaign to fight for Nike to pay their fair wages and fair share here in Oregon. So, you know, I would say folks should seek that out. It's for all folks in the community.
Union Hall?
Yeah, it'll be at the PAT Union Hall. People can register at the bit.ly. It's not a super sexy link, but bit.ly/4G6SI. So, you know, come join us. We also have been working with other locals in OEA to strengthen our bonds across the city and across the area, including like the locals that don't get talked about that are still Portland city districts like Park Rose and David Douglas, and working with places like Reynolds, Woodburn. We've also built connections with locals across the country. We were able to bring in Marsha Howard from Minneapolis to share her experience, as well as my mentor, Nate Gunderson, who's from Minneapolis, around fighting back against ICE, and doing a webinar with Portland Jobs with Justice around what are the next steps after the Labor Says ICE Out rally, where we were tear gassed, that I was an MC of. We are also working on our alliance around Oregon called Oregon Rising with nonprofits and other locals to really work on shared demands and fight for things with shared strategy, similar to things that have been done in Tennessee, Minnesota, Massachusetts, that are, you know, we're connected with AFT Oregon Together Lab, who we've done a lot of trainings around ICE and neighborhood organizing, Jobs with Justice, Extinction Rebellion, CPPS, PSU AUP, the Welcome Home Coalition, a diverse group of folks representing almost 40,000 people in the state of Oregon, and working to build that so that we can get what we need as working class people.
Wonderful. What do you see as some of the more existential threats to public education nationally and then locally here in Oregon and Portland?
Yeah, I think the existential threats have been ongoing, and we're just kind of seeing the fruits of those threats right now, right? It's the chronic underfunding, the lack of funding of IDEA, all of the title work that needs to be done, the devaluation of this feminized profession of education, because we still live in a misogynistic society and a patriarchy. And so because this is predominantly done by women, we are devalued, same as nurses. I think that has threatened public education, and the propaganda of Christian nationalism has pushed folks to think, well, maybe if I pull away from public school and homeschool, or send them to a charter, or send them to a private religious institution, that I can get a better education. But all that does is drain money away from public education, so we can't serve people. And what it does is provide profit for folks who see that there's a way to make profit out of education. It's one of the last public goods that isn't fully privatized, public education. And so, of course, the threat is corporations coming in and trying to privatize it through contracting, trying to privatize it through alternative education that doesn't actually serve all students and isn't up to the same regulations. I think the lack of funding, the lack of respect, and the lack of sustainability are huge threats to public education nationally, statewide, especially, and locally. Our legislators don't care. They don't care about education. I've had enough conversations with them where they just say, it's the governor's fault, it's the rep's fault, we gave you enough money. The teachers are literally telling you they don't have enough funding to do the work they have to do. The fact that they haven't called a state of emergency, that is a dereliction of duty. And at this point, all of them should be pulled out of office. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they think that they've given enough money, and yet year after year we see cuts, 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 class sizes ballooning. I mean, we just, like, we've gone down in our building. I know other buildings had extreme cuts this year for next year. And it's like we are at the bare bones here. And the fact that now on the table is either furlough days or 220 cuts, further cuts this year, is like, how could we possibly function with 220 fewer educators when we're already barely getting by right now?
Yeah, I make it very explicit that it's both and, right? PPS having to cut over $120 million since 2024 is not only district dysfunction, it is definitely state underfunding, because every budget should match inflation in order to be a zero cuts neutral budget, and they don't. And in addition to inflation, they need to be funding for labor union COLAs, because they know that we bargain them. Why would they give us exactly what we had the year before plus a little bit more change and say that should be enough, right? It's preposterous.
Well, yeah, and even just running a school building itself is costing more money.
Mm-hmm.
No. Well, unfortunately, we are almost out of time. So I do want to ask, What will you be doing after your term ends? Where will you be teaching? And what are you excited about returning to the classroom or
Well,
to school?
yeah, well, I am teaching is my dream job, and I'm excited to go back into schools. I am unassigned after being out of the classroom for 4 years. So I am waiting to hear what my options are and where I will be assigned to. Hopefully elementary, and just seeing and working with kids every day. That's the dream, and that's what I'm excited about.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experience and your wisdom. And thank you, as one of your members, for all that you've done for education and for our union. Thank you for joining us on KBOO. Thank you, Jamie Partridge, for making a radio ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. to catch another.
Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
Hello, my name is Jeff and I host the show A Matter of Public Records, which broadcasts on KBOO the first, second, and fourth Saturdays of every month from 3 to 6 a.m. It is a somewhat eclectic show suitable for the end of night or to be listened to at the start.